As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
All right, the latest episode of Hear That Podcast Ground is presented by Visa, a network working for everyone. And as always, Paul Dana Jr., Jay Morrison of The Athletic are here working for you. What's going on, Jay?
Oh, not much. You know, I'm actually kind of happy this morning. At the risk of people turning the pod off immediately, I do just want to mention
great
that
way to start.
I thought it was a great Survivor finale last night. And I was pleased by the outcome and a little surprised. But yeah, it's always good to wake up the next day after watching some quality television and still thinking about it.
You know what? I'll use that as a teaser for end of pod Survivor talk.
Okay.
I've got thoughts as well. and I think I have a great idea that I can throw over to another Survivor podcast. That's right. I'm listening to another Survivor podcast. That I thought was fantastic, which I will discuss at the end of this podcast. So for those of you who are really excited to stay to the end now, the nine of you that love our Survivor talk, we appreciate it. We got a lot to get to. We're going to talk a lot about the game. And I know that's weird for some people. This year has been very weird that way. We've talked about the games a lot. Very different for December. But this is one of those where... I'm not turning in the must-win armband, as we discussed on Tuesday. But Denver might be. Mm-hmm. Our good friend Nick Kosmider might be. In Denver, we're going to talk to him about the Broncos and where they're at in their season. And they're a very interesting team in a lot of different ways. But he'll talk about maybe him turning his own little must-win armband over there for a Broncos club that is better than I thought they would be. I think better than a lot of people thought they would be.
Yeah, for sure. And especially after getting rid of Von Miller, and they've almost gotten better since then. You don't see that kind of thing happen. And, you know, Teddy Bridgewater at quarterback, I think everybody thought was just kind of a bridge, no pun intended, guy, but he's doing what he needs to do to keep this team in contention.
Yeah. And so we're going to kind of break down the logistics of this game. Does it fit? Does it not fit the Bengals? A lot to get to there. Dan Pompey has a great story up now on Trey Hendrickson. I know he's been working on this one for a while, and it's great. We Jesse Bates made the joke earlier this year about blackout Trey, and he is a different dude, especially when it gets not just to game day, but apparently just close to game day. Apparently, just within like 24 hours of game day, he will ship his family off to a hotel and kick them out of his house if they think they're going to come stay there. It's like he is, it was really good insight into kind of the dichotomy of a breakout player, a free agent signing for the Bengals. So highly recommend reading Dan's story if you get a chance. Jay has a story, kind of a compilation of a very newsy day of everything kind of went down at Paul Brown Stadium on Wednesday and this week as they prepare for Denver. And so we've got a bunch of other news to get to. Let's run through some of that. I've got a story on man versus zone that we're going to dive more into. We're, of course, going to have our Bengals growler bet, predictions, run, pass, or boot. Also, I don't know that people realize how insane the history between Bengals and Broncos is. It shouldn't be. Like, I mean, they don't play all the time. It's not like there's a rivalry. When these two teams get together, it gets weird. And it's memorably weird. I promise we will not spend a bunch of time on Brad St. Louis again. We apologize for that. That got a little out of hand. But when you really start looking at it, it's crazy the amount of memorable games. So we're going to kind of just tick through a few of those. Maybe we'll rank our most memorable, Jay.
I can do that.
Yeah. All right. I want to talk about where we're at with news here. So COVID's a story, as it has been for a year and a half now, but it is kind of back to the forefront in the NFL, as in particular Cleveland, for Bengals interest, dealing with 18 people on the COVID list, Baker Mayfield, Kevin Stefanski, multiple offense. I mean, it's wild. And they're going to have to play Saturday against the Raiders in it. You know, we talked a little bit. Like, the second you mentioned some team are the Browns now the front runner in the AFC North? Boom. All of a sudden their whole team is gone, including their quarterback and head coach for a game on Saturday. We talked a little bit about with Zach Taylor about this, and the Bengals have done a really good job through 2 years now of avoiding this. Now, I don't know how much is them, how much it's luck, but you know, they have been on top of it and been able to stay out of the way of it really ruining games or, you know, stretches of the season.
It feels like it. Yes, they do. They are cautious in the building and there's protocols in place, things you have to do. It almost feels like their success in kind of warding this off has been on the players, because once they leave the building, there's things they can do that can put themselves at risk. And you see it across the league. I mean, the numbers right now that are exploding it's crazy, because the league is 94% vaccinated, and that's right in line with about where the Bengals are. And it's been proven now that being vaccinated does not guarantee you're not going to get the virus. And I think that it's the Bengal players, guys like Joe Burrow and Ja'Marr Chase, who aren't going out and living the star athlete party life. They're going home and grinding away, relaxing or grinding away at film, and kind of, you know, being responsible and professionals. And I think that has to be a big reason why this team hasn't been hit. I mean, they put Clay Johnston on the COVID list earlier this week. That's only the sixth player all year that they've put on the list. I mean, there's five other teams that have six on the list or more right now. It's just, maybe part of it is luck, but I do think a big part of it falls back on the players doing the right thing and buying in. And part of that probably comes down to belief that this could be a really special year and not wanting to jeopardize anything. And now, as they're in December and seeing it come to fruition, I think they're just being even more diligent about what they're doing in their free time and where they're going.
I think part of it is what we see pop up a lot during the week, and that's guys not practicing due to illness, and that's dudes being smart enough to not come to the building if they're feeling even a little bit sick, and understanding what that can do, and avoiding all of that is part of it. I think you're right. I mean, trying to put together a roster of guys that, you know, when they talk about high character and all that stuff, I mean, whatever, but guys that just will always kind of try to do the right thing, whether it be on the field, off the field, whatever, has always been a big focus of the roster they've constructed. And you have a team of guys like that and are kind of willing there. So now going forward, you know, that you may see some more Zoom meetings. You may see them using different, you know, using the space in the building again, kind of like you saw last year, a little bit more, just being extra cautious as we see it kind of just run rampant throughout the league. And it really debilitate a bunch of teams at this point, including, as we mentioned, the Browns. So, you know, that Browns result on Saturday is a big one for the Bengals. As we kind of try to track, we've talked about, look, beat the Ravens, beat the Browns, catch the Ravens, and you feel good. But, you know, if the Browns beat themselves first, It does clear the way for the Bengals. Another opportunity if they could seize it, but we'll see what happens with Case Keenum. Assuming Case Keenum's going to play on Saturday in the Browns, so that we want to watch. Necessarily announcement on punt returner, kick returner, which we discussed on Tuesday with those jobs up for grabs. But we did see who was practicing catching punts on Wednesday's practice, and that was the usual suspects, really. Trent Irwin, Tyler Boyd, Trent Taylor. And, we did ask about, there's only four games left in the season. Are you more willing to put Tyler Boyd back there? Just because we're only talking about a smaller sample size. And he was like, four games. No one wants Tyler Boyd to get hurt on punt return, okay? This is a team that just watched Logan Wilson go down on a punt team. So, it sounds like I have a feeling we're going to see Trent Irwin up and be your punt returner, but with Boyd kind of maybe there in the background just in case as maybe your backup. But the fact that nobody else was out there on Wednesday suggests we're not going to see anything crazy that we haven't already seen. As far as kick returner, I don't really know where they're going to go with that. That may be a Puka call up again or whatever, but it's harder to know where that's going to land.
Yeah, that feels like the direction they would go. Maybe at Thursday's practice, we'll see them do kick return and get a better idea. And I agree with you on punt return. Trent Irwin feels like the most likely. I had it in my story last night that he's averaging 10.3. Now he doesn't have that many returns to actually qualify as a league leader, but he would be one of the league leaders in punt returns with that average. He's solid. He's tough. We've seen it how many times in the preseason, what he had got crushed, took two hits that were penalized for a defensive player or helmet to helmet and bounced up both times from him. He did fumble on one of them. But the penalty saved him there. But he gives you that extra receiver too, where in a pinch he can go in there in the slot, or if they go five wide, he can give you some snaps out there and be a possession guy on a third down or in the red zone. So I don't know if they would be comfortable putting Trent Taylor on the field as a receiver at this point. He's been on the practice squad the entire season. So it feels like Irwin is going to be the guy.
Let's play another game. Let's play predict the starting offensive line and starting cornerbacks. Okay. I'll start left tackle, Jonah Williams, left guard, Quentin Spain. Trey Hopkins had an illness, as did Trey Hill, as did Isaiah Prince that kept him out. It sounds like they'll be okay. That was more precautionary and the stay home stuff. Akeem Energy didn't necessarily play very well. Got a vote of confidence from Brian Callahan that he's the guy for the rest of the season. He's done enough. He had a tough matchup against Eric Armstead, and that's kind of what it was chalked up to. So Akeem Energy will be the guy. Isaiah Prince should be the right tackle, but again, illness. So we don't know. You assume he'll be better, but Isaiah Prince could be right tackle. If Hopkins is better, he'll be the guy. But again, these illnesses that hang out there do kind of make you wonder how it could play out.
Well, and two, I mean, Adeniji was limited yesterday in practice with a knee injury. We don't know. I guess we'll find out more today if that was something that he suffered in the 49ers game, or if it was something that happened in practice yesterday that caused him to leave and be limited. So that's another injury concern there. I almost proposed a growler bet for this week on number of snaps by guys named Trey, because the Bengals have five guys named Trey on the team, spelled three different ways, by the way. And you could actually see all five of them getting snaps. Trey Hopkins, Trey Hill, Trey Flowers, Trey Waynes, and Trey Hendrickson. And all of them have questions and all of them could play. So I thought that would be a fun one, but we're going to go a different direction with the growler bet.
Yeah, I'm kind of curious to try to figure this out, because that is a really hard one.
It is.
That is one that we need to bring up Sunday when we're thinking about the game. Because I like that one. I like that one a lot. I mean, You're right. Every single Trey has a question. I guess Trey Flowers is the most solid.
But he still has a question here because of the ripple effect with Trey Waynes. Yes. How much Trey Waynes plays is going to affect how much Trey Flowers plays.
Trey snaps. I'm going to think about that. So, yeah, you're right. So will Trey Waynes play? I think Trey Waynes is going to play. You know, when it looked like they were kind of going through their walkthrough type stuff, it was Eli Apple and Trey Waynes that looked like were kind of in the starting positions. So, but how much will he be on a pitch count? You know, they kind of mentioned putting on a pitch count. So will Cheeto be able to go? How much will he be able to go? Thinks that that might kind of be similar to last week. Does that push Eli Apple out? Do they just kind of rotate Apple? Obviously Hilton will be in the slot. What does that do for guys like Trey Flowers? I mean, you go down the line, Darius Phillips is now on IR. They placed him on IR with the shoulder Tuesday. I don't know if that was a polite way of saying, please step back, or if his shoulder really is messed up. Either way, stashed in case things go totally sideways in the cornerback room down the stretch. So it's kind of a mess to see how cornerback is going to play out. It's going to be really curious.
Yeah, Cheeto chief among them. I mean, he gutted it out last week, and he had to come out of the game, and we'll see how he responds this week. But he played well, even though he was playing through that injury last week. He played well in that game, and they are going to need him down the stretch. It might be one of those what's good for the long run versus what's good for right now. But when you're sitting 7-6, you really don't have that luxury of looking at the long run.
I mean, to me, isn't there the chance here if Cheeto's going to kind of struggle to get through a full game, which we saw last week, he gave him everything he got but couldn't finish. Trey Waynes, you're not sure would do a full game. Maybe those two become a little bit interchangeable. Give Cheeto a series off, tell him, get on the bike, stay warm, but we're not going to kill your ankle here over and over again. Let's give Trey Waynes a couple of series, see how he's doing, and leave Apple on the other side. And maybe at some point, if everybody's feeling okay, you end up with the elusive trio of Trey Waynes, Cheeto Bay, Awuzie, and Mike Hilton. Who knows? But to me, it seems those two can kind of play off each other a little bit as a way to help Cheeto get through a full game and get Trey Waynes' feet wet on a little bit of a snap count. But again, that is probably going to come down to the end, just like it did last week. All right, let's take a second and switch gears here and hear from a sponsor.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard. Victorinox, the makers of the original Swiss Army knife, have been a reliable companion for life's everyday challenges, mastering functionality, innovation, iconic design, and uncompromising quality with its products. The Victorinox Swiss Army knife provides you with all the things you don't think about until you need it: tweezers, a screwdriver, and even a corkscrew. With the Victorinox Swiss Army Knife, you can be prepared to master everyday life. You can find Victorinox Swiss Army Knives at Dick's Sporting Goods.
Another thing I want to talk about is kind of newsy. We talked to Jesse Bates on Wednesday. It was the first time we talked to Jesse in a little bit since he had kind of a run of some rough games, and in particular the dropped interception. He was obviously asked about it. He talked about it. Here is Jesse Bates from In Front of the Mic Cart on Wednesday talking about, you know, the interception.
The dropped interception at the end of the fourth quarter, is that something that you watch 50,000 times and beat yourself up about? Do you bury it? How do you
do that? People say it's a 24-hour rule. I still haven't kind of gotten over it. I've probably seen the play probably 100 times now. I mean, it's very frustrating, honestly. You know, I did everything right. I feel like that play, I hung on the hash. I knew exactly what was coming. And I just tried to put it away a little too early. I didn't catch it first. So very frustrating at a critical point of the game as well. But we've got four opportunities left. I think I'll have a couple more of those opportunities to make, and I'll make them.
Listen, I think you walk in on that. you think you score on that? Catch the ball.
No one knows. Only God knows. But yeah, I think I would have probably had a chance. I think the only guy there was Kittle and Vaughn. But like I said, it's, you never know.
Did I get a piece of your arm at all when he went by?
I don't think so. I just completely dropped it, I think.
So there's Jesse Bates, and it's been a topic, obviously. And here's just thing, and this might be a soapbox. I'm not sure what's going to happen here, Jay. But like, I think that something that gets lost, and this always happens when guys end up in these contract talks, whether they sign the contract, whether they're in discussions, whether they're about to be up, and it's like, should you sign them? Should you not? It turns like the conversation turns so vitriolic around them, you know, and they become these robots deserving of scorn, right? It's just like, who are you? You got to make that play. And I'm so, but like, there's always a lot. And that was a play that Jesse Bates should make. He's obviously, I mean, you hear it in his voice. It's like, it is killing him that he didn't make that play. And, you know, it's football, man. Things happen fast. It happens. He needed it. He needed to make that play. But you drop the ball sometimes. Like, that's what it is. And as tough as that is to swallow for fans and for Jesse, I just think we forget that they're people. And they're people that, and Jesse, outside of that, played a fairly good game. He played well. But we all get caught up in that, and people yell and scream and do the internet thing. And I just, you know, when you hear him talk, and when we saw him talk yesterday, I just think people forget this is just a dude who wants it so bad and didn't make a play and made a mistake. And I don't know. And maybe that's a little, maybe it's soft of me. Maybe we should be crushing this guy and yelling more about how he doesn't deserve money. But I have a hard time doing that when you kind of hear him and the way how much it's just been. I can only imagine behind closed doors how it's killing him if he was the way he talked about it with us.
Yeah, and I think it does come down to, you know, the fact that we have access to him and we talk to him and we see what he's about. There's so many fans that maybe their only experience with the Bengals is 3 hours on Sunday. Coming to the game or watching on TV, they don't pay much attention elsewhere outside of the actual game. I think that's where a lot of the vitriol comes from, and those are the ones that do look at him as kind of robots. And you know, it might be a little different if Jesse was this trash talker and super brash guy, and you know, then you make a mistake like that, and it's kind of that Schadenfreude where, you know, people kind of take glee in someone else's misfortune. And that's not the case with him. He's always been a confident guy, but never that cocky, brash type of player. And he's always been very real with us and very honest. And you could just see how much it hurt him. And he talked about having what every player says, that 24-hour rule where you 24 hours to celebrate or 24 hours to commiserate, and then you move on. And he said he was having a hard time doing that this one was really sticking with him. And I don't know, it hasn't been his best season. I don't know how much the contract situation comes into play with that. I'm sure it's something he thinks about during the week, maybe even pregame, but I don't think it's affecting his play in game. I've never played sports at that level, not even close to that level, obviously, but I can't imagine with everything going on that can be in the back of your mind. You are so focused on the next play and your assignment and all that I don't know that it affects how you play in a game. I mean, think about it. You could be at a backyard cornhole game, just sipping beers, having fun. And if it's 19-19, it's you are locked in and you are not thinking about anything else that's going on except that game that you're playing right now. And it's times 1,000 for NFL players. So I don't think the contract situation is leading to some of the plays that we've seen, some of the uncharacteristic bad plays we've seen from Jesse Bates this year. It's just it's just something that like you said, it happens now and again, and he's beating himself up over it. I would expect him to come out and be motivated for a couple reasons. One, for trying to make up for that drop, and two, being on the same field with Justin Simmons on Sunday, who is paid like and performing like one of the top safeties in the league, and someone that Jesse has gotten to know on a personal level and is very fond of.
Jay, I'm glad you brought up backyard cornhole tournaments. Because I slightly disagree with one of your points, and that's the perfect way to connect it.
Okay.
As you know, the Dana Cornhole Classic is a popular event that's very close to my heart, the cornhole tournament that we do every year. It's coming up on 20 years here soon. And I haven't won since 9, okay? I pride myself on being a good cornhole player. I have feel like I've been a bit snake bit by myself and circumstantially over the recent years. If people would like for me to go run through the yearly history of that, I'd be happy to do it. Just let me know if you want a podcast where I only talk about the history of my performance in the Dana Cornhole Classic. But that is in the back of my mind when I played, and I am very much comparing myself to the professional level of Jesse Bates. But I do, I'm using it as a joking microcosm. But I do think when there is something that is in your head, when you are out there, there is a sense of it feeling like a extra pressure on the moment of maybe not spoken, maybe subconscious. But there is an extra pressure on the whole season, on an extra pressure on the way that you prepare, on the pressure you put on yourself during the week, rather than just feeling like you're playing free and easy and loose and confident. And there's a lot of psycho stuff. And like, you know, we could do, bring on a sports psychologist to talk about that type of stuff. But I don't think it's nothing. I'll say that much. I don't think that I would put that on dropping a ball that's a bang bang play when you're trying to sprint across a field in the middle of a big moment. Like, guys drop passes, you know, and it was the worst timing ever to drop one, and especially like you said, you feel like you played it perfectly. You did everything right. You baited the throw. You baited the mistake that Jimmy G always makes in the biggest moment. You were right there and you drop it and it just kills you. It's one of those things that you just gotta power through. I'm with you. I think you'll see him continue to play well as we go forward. I just wanted to kind of get that out of the way, but I want to talk about, I got a story up about man versus zone, and this may make people's eyes gloss over who are just like, oh, are we going to get football-y? Are we going to go into like the deep X's and O's stuff? I'm going to try not to. I don't want to do that. But I do want to point out that I don't think this is about deep X's and O's necessarily, even though as on the surface it is. It's about how teams are trying to stop Joe Burrow and and a pretty clear method of that they're using, and a pretty clear method of how the Bengals can reach an elite level for their offense over the last quarter of this season. And it comes down to this. Teams have stopped playing man against the Bengals. Understandably, they're like, look, when we go out there, we try to match up against Tyler Boyd, T. Higgins, and Jamar Chase, we can't do it. Ever since Marlon Humphrey got ripped up by Jamar Chase and what T. Higgins has been doing, anytime anybody tries to man him up, ever since, teams are just like, nah, like, we're just going to sit. We're going to sit back in zones. We're going to keep it in front of us. We're not going to let you do that. Well, you know why? San Francisco only ran one play of man coverage. One. And it was that it maybe been the best throw of the game. Was T. Higgins beating a play, a man defense designed to stop a deep inbreaker, and ran the deep inbreaker right across his face, and Burrow planted a seed right where Higgins could get it. Brian Callahan said it was probably the best throw of the game outside of the greatest improvisational play he's seen in person, which was the fourth and five that everybody saw. But that's an important note. So since week eight, no one has seen more zone than the Bengals. That's what outside of the Lions, who only see zones where they're getting blown out and then everyone just sits back and soft zones. This is how teams are trying to stop Joe Burrow. You want to know why? Because against man coverage, he is the best in football. Here's some rankings in key stats of him versus man, just versus man coverage. This is via True Media and Pro Football Focus. QB rating, second. Adjusted net yards per attempt, first. Yards per attempt, first. How about 11.1 yards per attempt against man? 2 yards better than anybody else in football. EPA, expected points added per dropback, third. Yak, yards after catch per completion, first. Completion percentage, second. Touchdown percentage, fourth. That's him against man coverage. I'm going to run down those stats against zone. Rating, 15th. Adjusted net yards per attempt, 22nd. Yards per attempt, 15th. EPA per dropback, 18th. Yards after catch per completion, 16th. Completion percentage, 10th. Touchdown percentage, 7th. Middle of the pack, right? So yeah, of course teams are like, beat us this way, right? We see who you are against man. We see who you are against zone. You're going to see 90% or more zone coverage because this is what you are having more trouble with. You go week over week, and this was a bigger problem earlier in the year. As the year has gone on, you started to see them start to chip away at getting better at it. And it culminated Sunday against the 49ers, where he had far and away his best game of the year against that zone coverage. Now, San Francisco has a bad secondary. We saw the magic that happened in the fourth quarter and overtime. But I kind of was asking if it felt like a breakthrough moment. Burrow didn't view it that way. Callahan said that's probably the wrong word to use for it. But it doesn't mean it wasn't substantial and important. That they're plucking things from, that they went back to some stuff they did earlier in the year. They were plucking stuff from the summer and kind of did some new stuff that helped them beat the San Francisco zone. So that's a bit of a breakthrough, finding more ways to do it and having confidence in doing it. And finding the way to beat the way teams have chosen to defend you. Just that surface level statement is a big deal. And that could be the difference between them being an okay offense or one that is elite enough to carry them into the postseason. And if Sunday was a big deal, or if it was just a high end blip and circumstantial against the 49ers.
You know, finding a way has been one of the strengths this year of this team. Every team's different, but the zone defenses that they're throwing at the Bengals, yes, that did feel substantial against the 49ers the way that Joe played. But I do agree it wasn't a breakthrough because they've done this before too, where they kind of adjust and they get it going in game. And we've seen they're so much better in the second half than the first half. So much has been made about the slow starts, but maybe not enough about the adjustments they make and how they kind of take off after they get it figured out. That they've scored 202 points after halftime this year. That's the most of any team in the league. So that gives you hope that if they can do it in the micro sense of a game, that they can kind of expand what happened last week against San Francisco and start getting better and better against zone coverage these last four games. And it's not all Burrow. A lot of it's going to come down to you should be able to run the ball against a zone defense and getting mixing going. And it comes down to the one other benefit of the defense playing zone is it takes a little bit longer for the receivers to get where they need to go and settled in, and for Joe to recognize, as opposed to sometimes if they're playing press man coverage, you get them beat right off the line and you know you're going with the throw right away to that guy. This offensive line is having a little bit trouble holding up, and so playing zone defense just might give the defense that little bit extra time of pass rush to get to Joe and affect it. But I think his recognition and his growth, and then Zach and Brian as well, being able to figure these things out as they're happening and adjust on the fly has been a strength this year. And it's going to be huge down these final four games.
I loved something that Burrow said on Wednesday. He talked about, as the game goes by, his ability to bank everything that they're showing him over the first step is why he feels like they get so much better, because there's only so many ways you can play me. There's only so many things you're going to be able to do. And once I know what you're trying to do, I know how to beat it. And he, obviously quarterbacks are very smart and teams know how to figure out what the other team's doing. He is rare in that way of being able to bank it on the fly and use it against you as soon as he's now seen it. And I think those numbers of points in the second half is a direct correlation to Burrow's ability to put the puzzle together quickly and understand how to beat it quickly. And that goes to the coaching staff too, but him being able to do it while he's out there on the fly. I think when he said that, it made so much sense of why, you know, we talk about slow starts. Well, yeah, you're also talking about taking advantage of what teams do show you. And it's, you know, there are games within the game, and there's a second game after the first game of seeing what the other team's going to try to do to you.
And sometimes that can be a misleading stat, the most points in the second half, because it could mean you're getting blown out. And then the defense, kind of like you mentioned with the Lions, where teams just sit back in zone and let you go. And that's not been the case. The Bengals have not had many blowouts this year. And the one that they did, they were getting blown out against the Chargers. And a good chunk of that comeback happened in the first half. Then the Cleveland game, they got blown out, and they never really piled on points at the end of the game in the second half to kind of pad that stat. So that is a legit number, 202 points after halftime.
Here's the other side of the man zone thing before we get to Nick in Denver, because we're going to ask him about this. And that is, look at the stretch run, the teams they're playing and how they're constituted defensively. Top six teams in terms of percentage of man defense played this year. So they play the most man. They do it because that's where they're comfortable. That's what they like to do. 2, Baltimore. 3, Denver. 6, Kansas City. That's what they like to do. It's the type of defense they prefer to play. It's the type of defense they have played. So how much will they revert to what we just talked about? And, you know, I mean, they're still also playing zone over 50% of the time. So it's not like it's something they don't do or can't do or wouldn't do more of. I would be stunned to see a team play 40% of man against them, but it's the chess match. How willing will the Broncos be to go out there and trust their corners against the Bengals receivers? How much of that will they see? How much do you prepare for that? You know, I asked Zach Taylor that, and he kind of talked about, look, you know, it's not like we may only rep it once during the week, but these would be plays that we have in the bank that we've done hundreds of times since May. And the ability that's what they did against San Francisco was they pulled stuff that they hadn't done. So the ability of those players to go out there and execute that at such a high level, stuff they hadn't really gone over lately, was a big confidence boost for continuing to do that. As teams do continue to show them more unscouted looks and things that they're just not doing all year, they're doing it to the Bengals because the Bengals are just different in the amount of weapons they have and how they're beating people. And so that ability could also be a big part in turning things going forward. So it'll be interesting to see what the Broncos do, how Vic Fangio chooses to approach this when he likes to play man, let his corners cook a little bit. And Joe Burrow says, please, please, please do that. Please do that. Please give me man coverage and let me rack up some numbers. I think that's a really interesting chess match. All right, let's just take a quick break.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this? A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them.
You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy.
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds.
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Visit DirecTV.com. Claim based on total games offered on national and regional sports networks with choice package or higher. Availability of RSNs varies by zip code and package. High-speed internet service required. Terms and restrictions apply.
Customers are rushing to your store. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. Shopify POS is your command center for your retail store. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify has everything you need to sell in person. With Shopify, you get a powerhouse selling partner that effortlessly unites your in-person and online sales into the one source of truth. Track every sale across your business in one place and know exactly what's in stock. Connect with customers in line and online. Shopify helps you drive store traffic with plug-and-play tools built for marketing campaigns from TikTok to Instagram and beyond. Get hardware that fits your business. Take payments by smartphone, transform your tablet into a point-of-sale system, or use Shopify's POS Go mobile device for a battle-tested solution. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Do retail right with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/theathletic, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/theathletic to take your retail business to the next level today. shopify.com/theathletic.
It's the perfect opportunity for us to get to our good friend, Nick Kosmider, out in Denver, who does a great job covering the Broncos for us on a very interesting team. And Jay, you had this interview with Nick, so we'll go to that right now.
Nick, how you doing today?
I'm doing great. Glad to be on with you guys.
Yeah, appreciate you doing this. A lot to get to with the Broncos. I guess just from a personal standpoint, I'm most interested in this whole kind of, I don't know, you want to say resurgence or just how well the team has played since the Von Miller trade. It almost seems counterintuitive for that to be the case, but it seems like things have really kind of taken off since then.
Yeah, I mean, they were 3-4 after a loss to Cleveland in week 7, after having lost 4 straight games in October. They look kind of down. Von Miller didn't play against Washington in week 8, and already the behind the scenes, the trade was getting put together. Mm-hmm. And so since that time, since kind of they started working on this trade, the Broncos, they've gone 4-2. They've looked like a team that is balanced in terms of playing really good defense, running the ball well, and occasionally getting some plays in the passing game when they need to. It's tough to explain because early in the year, Miller was playing well. I do think as kind of the season went on, he started to show his age a little bit. You're seeing that with the Rams as well. But Bradley Chubb, the outside linebacker for the Broncos, said, listen, that was kind of a wake up call for everybody that like anybody could be traded. Anybody could be, sent out of here. And I think they just kind of coalesced around the idea that everybody kind of needed to pick it up. And sure enough, they've gone from looking like they were going to be well outside the playoff race to right in the thick of it with 4 games to go.
Yeah, I mean, since the trade, Broncos 10th in sacks, 9th in pressures. I guess, Bradley Chubb, you mentioned him. He was out with the ankle injury at that time. Was this always kind of the plan for him to come back about this time, or was he ahead of schedule? He's been back for 3 games now.
Yeah, they targeted for him because he had off-season ankle surgery, but then right at the end of training camp kind of hurt his other ankle, missed the week 1 opener against the Giants, played a handful of snaps in week 2 against the Jaguars, and then decided that they were going to need to do another surgery on that opposite ankle. And they had always targeted the bye week, so when they came back and played the Chargers, that was kind of the target, and he did play in that game, about half the snaps before kind of going full bore against the Chiefs a week later. And so he's now played 2 full games and a half of another. Hasn't been able to get a sack yet, but he looked a lot better in the win over the Lions on Sunday. And they're going to really need him, obviously, in this game to be productive. You know, Draymond Jones is a big reason. Those numbers that you talked about, Draymond Jones, first 7 games of the year, didn't have a sack. He has 5.5 in the last 6 games to lead the team. Had 2 on Sunday against the Lions and has just been really a beast on the interior of that 3-4 scheme for Vic Fangio. He's dealing with a foot injury. He's going to be a little bit iffy for Sunday, but he's a big part of why they've been able to kind of still bring that pressure despite Miller's absence.
Yeah, I was going to get to the injuries here in a little bit, but since you brought it up, let's hit it now. I think there were five starters that missed practice Wednesday. You know, what are these kind of not maintenance days, but just kind of precautionary days off? Or is there some concern on some of these guys other than Jones that won't be able to go?
I think the majority of it is kind of maintenance stuff. You know, you got Kareem Jackson, who the safety, he tends to miss a practice a week after throwing his body around on Sundays. He had a stinger in the win over the Lions, but I think he'll be. We talked to him yesterday. He seems like he'll be good to go. You know, same thing for right tackle Bobby Massey. Vic Fangio called that mostly a rest day, even though he's dealing with a few injuries. Melvin Gordon, same thing, tends to miss a practice every week, but he's only missed one game this year, and he was excellent against the Lions, 111 yards and two touchdowns. And that's really been the key for Denver's offense, is that dual rushing attack with Gordon and rookie Javonte Williams. That's their whole bread and butter on offense right now. And I think Gordon will be in there. And so, yeah, I think for the most part, the Broncos are healthy. The one other thing to watch, they have their starting outside linebacker Malik Reed on the COVID list. He went on that 2 days before the Lions game. Vic Fangio said Wednesday that he's feeling better, but still hasn't posted the negative tests yet required to get back. So we'll have to see how that goes.
You know, kind of, I do want to talk about the running back situation, but I want to stick with the defense, piggybacking off the pass rush. Paul has a great story up today about how Joe Burrow has just torched man coverage this year, and they're just not seeing it anymore because he's been so good against it. Broncos play the third most man of any team in the league. You pull your crystal ball out. How do you think Vic Fangio is going to attack this Bengals offense and Joe Burrow?
Yeah, I've been kind of writing about this for, you know, a preview story a little bit, but I kind of see it going the same way that the Broncos attacked Dallas in week 9 when they won that game 30-16, had a 30-0 lead late in the second half, where they really more or less kind of stacked the box against Ezekiel Elliott and committed to stopping the run and allowed their corners to all play man coverage everywhere else on the field, virtually the entire game. They did benefit from a few Dallas drops, but overall they were excellent, you know, down the field in coverage. And that's, you know, that's kind of the strength of this team, right? They invested a lot of money into the cornerback position. They used their first round pick on Pat Surtain, who has been excellent. So I wouldn't be surprised, even though that is a strength, as you mentioned, of Joe Burrow's. I wouldn't be surprised if Vic Fangio is ready to kind of match strength against strength and really kind of sell out to stop Joe Mixon. I looked at it, obviously. The Bengals 2-4 in their last six games. In the two wins, Mixon has averaged 144 yards. In the four losses, it's, I think, 52.2 or something in that neighborhood. So I think the way Vic Fangio has talked about is he really does view limiting the Bengals on the ground as a top priority in this game. And so that would be my best guess. But Fangio has a way of kind of like mixing things up that you didn't expect, especially against young quarterbacks that he's facing for the first time. So I'm very intrigued by what he'll try to do to the Cincinnati offense.
Yeah, he did that at Dallas, right? They started in man and then flipped to zone in the second half. And I guess the lead kind of plays into that. But yeah, you really don't know what you're going to get with him. Going back to the running backs I mentioned, I'm just the numbers are amazing. Just the split there, the carries, the yards, everything looks perfectly equal. But as someone who's seen every play of every game, how does it break down? Do they do it by drive? Do they kind of lean on the younger guy, Javonte Williams, in the second half when he's a little fresher? How does that split work in terms of load management?
Yeah, it has typically been, for the majority of the season, it's been a drive-by-drive situation. Melvin Gordon has started every game. I mentioned the only game that he didn't play was their loss a couple weeks ago in Kansas City, in which Javonte Williams was incredible, had 178 total yards of offense and a touchdown. But yeah, they have gone series by series. Now they'll, depending on the length of the series, sometimes if it's longer, which, you know, a lot of their drives have tended to be that way. You know, they might bring the other guy in, toward the end of the series, or if one of them gets dinged on a play, you know, you might see some in series switching, especially in the red zone. But by and large, that's kind of how they've done it. drive one belongs to Melvin, drive two belongs to Javonte, and they just continue to kind of rotate it in that way throughout the rest of the game. And it has been wild. They had this plan basically early in training camp. As soon as they kind of realized that Javonte Williams could do all the things that they needed him to do, i.e., you know, pass protection, be able to read everything and know his assignments in that regard, which he's done a really good job of, you know, catching the ball, doing all the kind of little nuanced things that you have to be able to do, because they wanted to make sure that they could completely interchange them and not have to call anything a different way dependent on who was in the game, which is what they had to do last year with Phillip Lindsay and Melvin Gordon being two very different running backs and Lindsay kind of struggling in pass protection. They had to be very mindful of who was in the game. This year, that's not the case. That they'll call anything with either back in the game, and that's what's been able to make this thing really work for them.
You know, talking to the Bengals coaches down at the Senior Bowl, they love Javonte Williams and Michael Carter, that whole tandem there. They like that idea of guys that share carries in college because they come into the league a little fresher, and they've already got torched by Michael Carter in one game this year, and now they're going to be hoping that the same doesn't happen with Javonte Williams. I don't know. We're what, 9 minutes into this, and I haven't even asked about the quarterback yet. And it's funny because yesterday during Zach Taylor's press conference, I don't remember him getting a single question about Teddy Bridgewater, and that never happens. What have you seen from him this year? I mean, obviously he's got decent numbers, but free agent year, has he done enough to prove he can be the quarterback of the future there? And is he just one of those kind of middling anonymous guys, or is he a guy that can lead this team to the playoffs?
I think that's kind of an interesting anecdote about him not getting asked about, because that's sort of how you view it with him, right? I mean, he was brought in here, you know, I think they always viewed this season as a strong young roster, you know, that could compete for the playoffs if they had a quarterback who would take care of the football and just sort of be professional and competent in kind of the critical situations where they needed him to be. And that's what he's done. I mean, you mentioned his numbers are going to end up being the best of his career. You know, he hasn't had a lot of full seasons under his belt, but he's been solid, 18 touchdowns, 7 interceptions, almost 3,000 yards. He's been a guy that has been as advertised in terms of what you expect from him each and every week. Now, they are going to, I think, in these final four games, run into some situations where they have to pass the football, and they've really struggled in the passing game the last several weeks. You know, Courtland Sutton, who they just signed to a massive extension, has 10 catches in his last 6 games. That's just not going to get it done in some of these games that they have coming up, and so that's been sort of the talk here is, yeah, it's great that they have this running game. It's served them well, but at some point they're going to be behind in a game and they're going to have to rely on the pass. And so far they just haven't been able to get that going of late. So that's kind of the thing with Teddy Bridgewater right now is, all right, he's gotten him here. He's put them in a position to be 7-6 and fight for these playoff spots. But how good can he be in these final moments that matter? Can he put them over the top? And you know, there's some trepidation about whether he can, you know, just given again what these receivers, the numbers that they've put up, the passing game just hasn't been there. And at some point it's going to have to be.
You know, you mentioned his 18 touchdowns. They've gone to 8 different guys. That's pretty amazing. Does he tend to spread it around throughout games, or is it more of a game by game thing where they kind of pick on a weakness and he has a, like one receiver will have a big game 1 week and then it's somebody else the next week?
Yeah, there's been like no guy for him, like on any given week. There hasn't been a situation where you come into the game and you say, yeah, he's definitely going to go to this guy a lot. I think you can always depend on Jerry Jeudy to have about 5 or 6 catches and, you know, at least 50 yards, just because he's almost, they're almost playing him like a safety outlet. He's running these really shallow crossers and, you know, little dig routes that will always get him a little bit open. They used him really well on this final second half drive when they went down and got a field goal, just kind of finding his soft spots in the defense. And the other guy you know will catch passes is Noah Fant, but they've rarely got him down the field. Most of his stuff has been, you know, line of scrimmage. He's among the tight end leaders in the league in catches, but he's like 70th and average depth of target. And so they've been able to get him the ball, but not in ways where he can really explode down the field. So that's, I think when you look at Teddy Bridgewater yeah, it there's nothing you can truly count on in terms of who he's going to get the ball to. And that has served them well at times. You mentioned eight guys have caught touchdown passes. He's used his tight ends well in the red zone, especially lately. And so that's something else to look for with Teddy Bridgewater, is that he can spread the ball around. A lot of guys will be involved. He's not the friendliest fantasy football quarterback. If you have his receivers on your team, you're going to be pulling your hair out. But, you know, that's something to watch for.
Yes, I have Jerry Jeudy, and I have been pulling my hair out.
Yeah.
I want to ask a question here to wrap it up. One of Paul's favorite questions about being a must win. I mean, 7-6, it kind of goes without saying that you know, it's crunch time. You got to win these games. But you look at Denver, and I mean, if they don't win this one, the division probably is off the table. And they're 3-5 in AFC games. It feels like, you know, they're going to be really fighting from behind in tiebreaker scenarios. Does it feel like this is one that they have to have if they're going to get to the playoffs?
Yeah, it certainly does, because you mentioned the AFC record. They're going to be on the short end of the tiebreaker situation in almost every scenario if they don't pick up this win. And then you just see who they face. I mean, they've lost 12 games in a row to the Chiefs. You know, they haven't beat the Chiefs since 2015. So you can't look at that Week 18 game and say, oh, they'll get that one. I mean, there's no reason to believe until they actually do beat the Chiefs that they will beat the Chiefs. They've lost 3 games in a row to the Raiders. And even though the Raiders are playing poorly of late, that's just been a tough matchup for them in the last couple years. And then, you know, with Justin Herbert, they have a win over him already. But that's a Chargers team that certainly can get hot at any time and give you problems. So the road after this game remains really tough for the Broncos, and so it's hard to see really any path for them if they don't win this game, because you like you said, you finish at best 10-7, which to me that would be a big stretch if you don't get this one, and even at 10-7 you might be on the outside of a tiebreaker. So yeah, they're viewing this as one that the Broncos have to have.
Bengal fans can commiserate with a team being dominated by another team, but you know, 11 straight losses to the Steelers, and then they not just swept them this year, they whipped them in two games. So it can flip. So
there's hope yet.
All right. Hey, Nick, great stuff. I really appreciate you jumping on with us, and look forward to catching up on the press box on Sunday.
Thanks a lot, Jay. I really appreciate it.
All right. Someone check Nick for his must win armband. Did he call it? Do we think he called it?
I think he did.
Yeah.
I think he had to.
Yeah, they're in a spot. They're in a spot where they do kind of have to. I mean, you're talking about, they got the Bengals, the Raiders, the Chargers, and the Chiefs. They're 7-6. Although they could lose this and go 10-7. But yeah, with the losing streak to the Chiefs and Patrick Mahomes,
and losing this would put them 3-6 in the conference. So that
they're a tiebreaker behind the Bengals, who they could be tied with. Bad conference record. Yeah, all those things do shout. This is kind of one they got to have. I'm with you on that. That's fine. So he turned it in. That's fine.
Yep.
We need to start questioning everyone's must-win armband every week that we have them on. I don't think Jeff Zrebeck has probably pulled out his must-win armband yet, since they've been kind of playing from ahead all year. But maybe he'll pull it out next week.
Yep. And then maybe Nate Jackson.
Make sure we ask that. All right. Let's talk a little bit about this game. There's a few things that Nick said that stood out to me that I think are particularly important. And when we talk about what it's going to look like from a Bengals defensive standpoint, when I see a team, I think this showed the last 2 weeks, and we discussed a lot about the Bengals defense and playing elite offenses and how will they step up. I trust this defense much more against a team that is very good running the ball than a team that's very good throwing it. I just do. And I thought that showed up in the Chargers game. And that showed up a little bit against San Francisco, where the defense played fairly well, defending San Francisco's varied and powerful running game. They're kind of just built that way a little bit more. So I think in a few ways, you know, that it's, look, their running game is what has fueled Denver, and Bridgewater can maybe beat you at some point. Hopefully they can, they kind of feel like. I think that's a good setup for the Bengals as far as a matchup perspective goes.
Yeah, I mean, these rankings can be kind of volatile early in the season, but we're middle of December and Bengals are fourth against the run. That's a body of work. They have been really good at that this year, and it starts with Ogunjobi and DJ Reader up front, and Jermaine Pratt has really kind of come on these last few games, and he's a liability in coverage, but he can fly to the ball, and if he gets in the right gaps, he can be a force against the run, and I think we're starting to see some of that. So you're right. I think there's less of a chance of this game getting away from them than it would be against a Justin Herbert or even, you know, a Baker Mayfield, teams that can go out there and just hit you with explosive play after explosive play. I don't think we're going to see that. I think this is one that's going to be tight throughout, and it'll be interesting to see how that two-headed monster works for Denver. They're running backs, because Melvin Gordon's been good in this league for a long time, but he's getting older and he's slowing down a little bit. And that's one of the reasons they went and got Javonte Williams, get a rookie with some fresh legs in there. And as Nick said, they like to go every other series with those guys and keep them fresh. We'll see, you know, big deal with Trey Hendrickson playing. He's been great, obviously, as a pass rusher, but he's been solid against the run too. And Sam Hubbard's been good against the run. And I don't think this Denver team, they're good. That's going to be their game plan, is going to be to try to run it against the Bengals. I don't know if they're going to be successful. San Francisco got to 100 yards. Not sure Denver can get there.
And that might be a big deal. I mean, if it's a high volume, 110 or something like that, it's not terrible, you know, if the efficiency is good. If looking for a little bit deeper of an analytical side of things, DVOA, Bengals defensive DVOA breakdown, 10th against the rush and 18th against the pass is how they view it. Basically, all goes into opponents' strength and the formulas that they have that have proven very well over the course of the years. So I think it's the numbers back up, I think, what our eye test says a little bit there too. Yeah, and that for that reason, I think it plays into their strength a little bit. I mean, force Teddy Bridgewater to beat you, right? I mean, the Bengals will not be the first team to come into this Denver game with that plan. But I think it's a good one when you do have some confidence in your secondary, you can contain them. And if you do that, you're certainly going to have a really good chance. And I think, you know, he talked about Draymond Jones. That'll be an important inactive to watch. The way interior pass rushers have given the Bengals problem and the way they have weaknesses on the inside, and obviously as effective as he has been of late for the Broncos, if he can go and be full strength, that could be a bit of a game changer for this one.
Yeah, like 5.5 sacks. What do you say? None in the first seven and now 5.5. I mean, he's on a tear. And Bradley Chubb, none yet. I mean, he's out on the edge, and you feel like that guy is going to get it going sooner rather than later. That will be a big part of this is that Denver pass rush. And I mean, we know how good they are on the back end. Their corners and their safeties are among the best in the league. That's one of the reasons they're second in the league in points allowed. I think this is going to be we talked a lot about Joe Burrow, but I think this is going to be a Joe Mixon game. They're going to have to ride him in this game, because it does. It feels like it's going to be a low scoring, tight game from start to finish.
Yeah, you know, it was interesting making the Dallas connection and trying to replicate the Dallas game. I mean, Dallas constituted very similarly to the Bengals in a lot of ways, with all the receivers and Dak Prescott and Ezekiel Elliott. I mean, you, the weaponry is kind of something that you talk about there. And the fact that they focused on stopping Elliott and played man behind against CeeDee Lamb and Amari Cooper. And I don't know if Cooper was in that game or not. He's missed a few this year. But you know what I'm saying? I mean, that would be an interesting strategy if they came out there and did that. And because you know, we've seen the opposite of that happening with teams lately. But Denver has a good defense. Vic Fangio has a good defense. It will be quite the chess match to see how they approach it and if they do use what Nick talked about. And obviously, if you feel like it's worked for you before, you would do it. I want to, before we dive into our growler bet and predictions and everything here. Can we do the history of this series, which is absurd?
I'd love to.
There's like every time there's memorable games. Every football game is memorable in its own way. But like 10 years later, memorable, generationally memorable.
Yeah.
Like that does not happen in anything outside of division very often. And now 2 weeks in a row, I would say the Niners Bengals had a bit of historical significance when you go back to the Super Bowls, of course. And Denver is just, it's memorable for its just absurdity. Maybe that's the ranking. Maybe we rank by absurdity. Hmm. I'm going to poke through a list that I have here and then we can rank of some of the games in the history of this series. And this is mostly with a recency bias of since 2000. Corey Dillon, 278 yards, breaks Walter Payton's longstanding NFL rushing record. Fairly memorable. First Monday Night Football game in a decade and a half for the Bengals. I mean, that was one that people remember very clearly because of the absence. And Chad beats Champ Bailey deep. Brad St. Louis, I won't go down that again. Stokely! You talk about memorable.
Talk about Gus absurdity.
Johnson on the Stokely tip ball call. Dre Kirkpatrick intercepts Peyton Manning for a house call to send the Bengals to the playoffs. A game I would argue is the biggest Bengals win in Paul Brown Stadium history. 2015, they go to Denver with the one seed on the line. After Andy Dalton had gotten hurt, a year that Denver did what? Won the Super Bowl with the one seed propelling them because they got all over Tom Brady in their house in the championship, AFC championship. They go to overtime after blowing a lead and AJ McCarron drops a shotgun snap. But a ton was on the line in that game. I also, Dre Kirkpatrick had a 103-yard interception return that he basically passed out on the four.
Did not score.
Pretty funny. That's just since 2000. Can we rank those by absurdity? Or do you have others that you're thinking of?
No, those were the ones I had. For notable, the very first win in Bengals history was also against the Broncos, but that's before a lot of our listeners were even alive. They did used to be division opponents. But yeah, if we're going absurdity, it's Stokely. I remember some of these games I was not at, but I remember vividly where I was. And my son played in a fall ball league and he was 9 years old and they played their doubleheaders on Sunday. And the team they were playing just happened to have a couple Denver fans sitting next to me. They were wearing Broncos gear. And so I'm kind of following the score on my phone. And I was like, oh, Bengals beat you guys. Cause I saw that the final touchdown was 30 seconds left. And I put my phone away. No idea what happened until I got home and realized the Stokely thing had happened. And I clipped that. I made my own DVD of that just because of Gus Johnson's call was so memorable and it was such an absurd play. I shouldn't say you'll never see anything like that again, but it for me, if we're going by absurdity, that's number one.
As absurd as that is, we have seen crazy plays to end games. And really, we've seen good rushing attacks, but we have never in NFL history seen a game like Corey Dillon rushing 22 times for 278 yards, breaking a record that stood for 34 years, 35 years at the time, and doing it with the most inept quarterback play you have ever witnessed. The Bengals were 2 for 14 for 34 yards passing. Denver knew all the Bengals were going to try to do is run it. And Corey Dillon ran 22 times for 278 yards to break Walter Payton's record. Peter Warwick had 3 for 90. I mean, the Bengals ran for 407 yards at 11 yards per carry and couldn't throw the ball for a completion for the life of them. Akili Smith and Scott Mitchell. To me, for absurdity, I'm giving that the absurdity award.
Yeah, you're right. I forgot about the 2 for 14 part because that does make it even more absurd. And if I remember right, that was my daughter's 4th birthday, and we were in Daytona Beach. I was listening to that game on Bengals.com while the family was down at the beach. I was in the condo listening to that game. If I remember right, they were pretty terrible. Were they like 1-6 or 1-7 at the time of
the Bengals?
Yeah, they might have even been winless.
They were over.
Yeah. So that just adds to the absurdity to come out. And Denver wasn't a great team that year, but they weren't bad. And yeah, that
they had one of the best rushing defenses in the league.
Yeah. 278.
Totally absurd in every way, shape, and form. And so for that fact, I give it to it. And I also want to point, I forgot, I skipped over AJ Green's first big game, week 2 of his rookie year. Mm-hmm. He went bananas in a 24-22. I think they lost.
Yeah, they did lose that one.
But he went off in that game, and it was like, oh, this AJ Green, he might be something. He was something. But anyway, a fun history here. So anticipate absurdity on Sunday is kind of the moral of the story. When these two teams get together, dogs and cats living together, mass hysteria. Let's Bengals growler bet. Jay, I think you got a good one for this.
Yeah. So we're going to go with kind of what we talked about earlier with the Bengals in the passing game, adjusting on the fly and getting better as the game goes. We're going to go with Joe Burrow passer rating in the 4th quarter. And just so if you want some numbers here, against the Chargers, Joe Burrow's passer rating in the 4th quarter was 35.1, the lowest of his career. He comes back the following week against the 49ers and posts a 151.0, the highest of his career. For the season, his 4th quarter passer rating is 89.2, which ranks 18th in the league. So really, this, you look at lowest of career, highest of career, and then where he ranks overall, this could go any possible way. Which way are you going to lean for Burrow passer rating in the 4th quarter?
Well, my prime number is 113. So 113 is my number that I'm going with in the 4th quarter and overtime, essentially. So that's my number.
I'm going to go 100.1.
100.1. Palindrome in effect. All right. I like it. And remember, you can shoot your answers or your thoughts to us, or if you have possible run passer boots, which, Jay, there is one in your wheelhouse that was dropped to us on Twitter. Hashtag run pass or boot, which I'm going to give you here momentarily.
Okay.
Maybe we'll do it with our Survivor talk so that people that want to check out can check out. I don't want to waste any more time. Run pass or boot. Here's what I got. What will this game be before we do our predictions? Will this be a 3-point game? Will this be decided by 2 touchdowns or more, or in between there? Well, people might not realize Denver has played 5 straight games decided by 13 points or more, so 2 touchdowns. The Bengals have 6 games decided by 3 points exactly, and the other 7 decided by 2 touchdowns or more. There's a certain type of game these teams have been playing. So the question is, what will be? Let's run pass or boot, or let's run pass or boot it.
I'm running all the way with 3 points or less.
It's not 3 points or less.
Three exactly.
Well,
what if it's So there could be a no win answer in this if it's two or one.
There could.
All right. Well, I'm going to say three exactly. Even though that's going to be the hardest one to hit, it just feels 2017 range. That's what this game feels like it's going to be. I'll pass on in between because maybe it's a 3-point game and someone gets a touchdown at the end to make it a 4-point game. And I'm going to boot the 2-TD game, even though that's what the Broncos have been doing lately. Either way, I can't see either one of these teams winning this game by 12 or more points.
I could see that. I could see the Bengals making some dumb mistakes and turning it over, and the Broncos taking advantage of that. It's how they beat the Chargers by 15. Now, I don't know that that's going to happen, but I could see it. So I'm going to run with exactly three as well. I'm with you. Feels that way. Denver thin air, long field goal to win it. Mm-hmm. McPherson at the gun.
66.
I am going to pass on the 2-touchdown game. And I'm just going to boot on in between because the Bengals don't play in between. Haven't all year. Bet the trend. So that's where I stand on it. All right. Prediction time, Jay. What do you got?
Yeah, I'm going to have to go Broncos 2017. The Bengals have been really good on the road this year, but I don't know. It's just, there's something about Denver. They don't play well out there. They don't play out there a lot, but when they do go out there, they don't play well. Even that the 2015 game you mentioned, they have AJ McCarron in at quarterback and they go 75 yards, 80 yards, back-to-back touchdown drives to open the game and then nothing after that. I think it's going to be a grinder game, and I think that, you know, it's going to come down to a Brandon McManus, the AFC Special Teams Player of the Week. It's going to come down to a kick by him late in the game to win it.
You mentioned it, and it's what's influencing me. I do think this team has, for whatever reason, just been a better, more focused version of itself away from home. And I don't know why that is. I don't understand the dynamics of it enough, but I've seen enough of it to look at the way they played in Vegas, the way they played at the Ravens. Granted, the Jets game was kind of a mess, but I still say the Jets game, they were up by 11 in the fourth quarter, and it was a 75-1 shot that they blow that. Really should still be talking about a win against the Jets, let's be honest. You know, the way they played at Detroit, the way they played at Pittsburgh,
Baltimore. I mean,
they have kind of been the best version of themselves away from home. They've not lost more than two in a row all year. And so I think they straighten themselves out. I think the matchup is good for them to show off their run defense a little bit. And I think Burrow is in lift all boats mode, and he might be in, hey, everybody, pay attention to me mode. And so I'm giving Bengals 24, Denver 21. Now, let's get to something more important, Jay. There's a run, pass, or boot here that I have for you. This comes from Jay Goney 2. Run, pass, or boot, heartbreaker edition. That's right. This is about heartbreakers.
Tom Petty?
Who has the best song called Heartbreaker? Led Zeppelin, Rolling Stones, or Pat Benatar?
I don't know if I know the Rolling Stones song Heartbreaker. So I'm going to boot that one because I'm not sure I even know what that is. And I'm not a big Stones fan anyhow. I'll go Zeppelin for sure. That one is strong. I do like some Pat Benatar, but I don't. She obviously doesn't compare to Zeppelin as a whole, and that's the Heartbreaker song doesn't compare. So I will definitely go with Zeppelin, pass on Pat Benatar, and boot Rolling Stones, and give an honorable mention to Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers.
Who never had a song called Heartbreaker, unfortunately. Yeah, it's a
missed opportunity.
Survivor talk. So thanks everybody for listening. that does not care. It was great to have you. We'll be back with the walkout on Sunday. So spoiler alert, in case you have not watched yet, I'm about to talk about the winner of Survivor. I'm going to give you time. Okay. So Erica is the big winner. And Xander makes the poor decision to bring her along, which I think it was properly pointed out that he did not have the ability to really read people. I think he played poker like I play poker sometimes. And I'm just like, really did not see that the way I should have, what was actually happening around me and how people respected Erica, which is fine. But what I really wanted to talk about, Jay, and do you have thoughts? I have another thing after this. Do you have thoughts on the outcome?
I knew it was coming when the Survivor editors kind of love the freezing cold takes idea of things. And when he said that, so-and-so said that they don't think I could beat Erica, I think they're wrong. Yeah. I just knew right then that's the way it was going to play out. And I was happy for Erica. I thought she played a great game. I don't know if anyone Xander's age is ever going to win this game. Cause I was stunned that he didn't get a single vote. I thought, yes, he might've had trouble reading people, but he made connections. He played a really good physical game. I just think people are like, we're not giving a 20-year-old kid $1 million. I was stunned that he didn't get a single vote.
Here's an idea that was brought up. Tyson, who used to be on Survivor, he's been on Survivor multiple mm-hmm. times. He has a podcast where he talks about it. He brought up this idea, and it's been stuck in my head ever since, and I'm obsessed with it now. I love they shoot these seasons back to back. I love the idea of a re-rack season. Everybody plays again. So season ends. Now, you can do it a number of different ways. We'll give you 3 weeks off in between to get your body right, eat healthy, start over at the beginning. Maybe you do it where you do a full season and then there's a long break. So you do it as the second shoot in Fiji 1 year and then the first shoot in Fiji the next year. So there's 6 months in between the shoot or whatever. But re-rack, and they know it ahead of time. You know you're playing two seasons with the same people. So there's like alliances in the long run. There's like short run and thought long run stuff. Am I trying to maybe win the second one? At what point do you feel like you're totally sideways in the first season and you got to start thinking about building for the second season? I love the idea of one cast playing, because the way the game falls is totally different each time. Totally different based on luck, based on the evolution of the game, based on knowing what happened last time. Like, I would love to see the same cast play twice. Because we talk all like these such great players and this, that, and the other. Like, I don't know. Sometimes it gets kind of lucky. I thought this is what I want and I'm obsessed with, and I might have to go sit at Jeff Probst's driveway and tell him.
Okay, so if they do that, do you want to see the same exact challenges in the same exact order, or do
yes,
you want that shuffled
I want,
up?
I would like for everything to be the same.
Because I think same. That's where a big part of the luck comes in is you might really need immunity going into a challenge, and if you're a little person and it's a strength, you're out of luck, or whereas if it's a one of those endurance or balancing things, it might play into someone who's smaller in stature. But yeah, that it would be interesting. I don't know ratings wise how much, because that's part of the fun of it is getting to know these people and seeing it play out. And it would almost, even though it would be a brand new season, it would still kind of have that rerun feel to it. And I don't know if everybody else would be as excited about it as you are. I think the ratings would really suffer.
Why do they do all-star casts?
Well, you mix them together.
Yeah, but no, they've done all-stars. They've done round twos of, I mean, they've done bring back people all the time. Yeah. They pay a lot of money to bring people back because they know people love watching people they know. You know, you feel like you got to know everybody over this season, and now you know them. It's almost like an all-star. but it's just the sequel. And I'm all on board. I don't think ratings would suffer at all. I think you would definitely bring back everyone that watched the last one. So I like it as a two-part series, maybe a trilogy. If you feel like you've got a great cast, round three, right? That's my thought. That's my Survivor thought. Thanks to the 14 of you that stuck around.
It would be fun, you know, if someone like Erica that won the first one and you come back the second time and things aren't going well and you just go scorched earth and start throwing rice away and just make it a total train wreck.
And people know your game now.
Right. Yeah.
But you know what I mean? So you almost got to play a different game or try to. And you're a total target if you were you won or in the end. Anyway, I love it. But it was a fun season. I enjoyed the season. Where did we end up in our Shan run passer boot that we did?
She went out 10th, so it was 10 to 12. I think we both ran with that one, so yeah. We both hit it.
Yeah, we both hit it. That was so many shots of her disapproval in the jury, and it's like, can we be done with this? Like, they just wanted it to be a thing so bad. Her like just disapproval towards every comment that was made and eye rolls and this, that, and the other. It's fine. I really like Ricard. He went real heavy on patting himself on the back.
Yeah.
Like real congratulatory for a dude who finished fifth for being too much of a front runner.
He got a little bitchy at the end too. So yeah, it kind of turned me off. My wife's big thing, you know, for people that watch know maybe the greatest fire making challenge they've ever had. And she was just beside herself because, you know, if Erica had to make fire, she had no hope. And she's like, how you get picked for Survivor? How much time do you have before you go? I'd be in my backyard every single day working on building fire. And it's amazing that people go out there and can't do it.
It does seem pretty hard to do.
I don't know. You got Flint.
Go out there. Spend all day today, Jay, working on how to make fire with Flint and stuff. Tell me if you're good at it by the end.
Well, I'm going to need some coconut husk and some twigs.
There's lots of coconut husk laying around Hamilton. Aren't there?
I don't think so.
All right. It's just me and you talking here. No one's
listening. No chance.
All right. Thanks. Thanks for the four of you that stuck around at the end. We appreciate you. And we'll be back with the walkout on Sunday after the game in Denver. Very much looking forward to this trip and a massive game for both sides. So a lot to break down afterwards. Thanks, everybody, for listening. We'll talk to you next time. Enjoy that podcast, Growl.